outside. She'd have found it annoying, but it was better than Gawain's sullen regret in previous battle engagements. He was looking pale, though, as if at the start of a sickness. Had he been getting enough sleep? "I want to go to the camp and find General Bryn," Egwene said. "I want to know why this was allowed to happen. And then I will go to our troops defending the ford and avenge our people who just lost their lives here." They both gave her frowns. "Egwene," Gawain said. "I have strength yet," Egwene said. "I have been using the Sang Greal to keep from having to work too hard. The men fighting in that quarter need to see me, and I must do good where I can. I will take as many guards as you wish me to take." Gawain hesitated, glanced at Llywyn, then finally nodded.
Lan dismounted and handed the reins to Andir, then continued past the guards, who seemed shocked to see him and his numerous guards, many of them bloodied, toward the command tent. The tent was little more than an awning now, open on all sides, with soldiers moving in and out like ants in a hill. The air was hot here in Shinar today. He had not received reports recently from the other battlefronts, but had heard his would not be the only desperate stand today. Elaine fought at Kyrian, the Ommerlin on the border of Arafel. Lights said that they were having a better time of it than Lan. Inside the tent, Agomar stood with maps on the ground all around him, pointing at them with a thin pole and moving bits of colored stone around as he gave orders. Runners would come and give updates on the progress of battle. The best battle plans lasted only until the first sword was drawn, but a good general could work battles like a potter working clay, taking the ebbs and flows of soldiers and molding them.
"Lord Mandragoran?" Agomar asked, looking up. "Light man, you look like the Blight itself. Have you seen the Aes Sedai for healing?"
"I am well," Lan said. "How goes the battle?"
"I'm encouraged," Agomar said. "If we can find some way to stall those dreadlords for an hour or two, I think we actually have a fair shot of turning the Trollocs back."
"Surely not," Lan said. "There are so many."
"It's not about numbers," Agomar said, waving Lan over, pointing at a map. "Lan, here is a thing that few men understand. Armies can and often do break when they have superior numbers, superior battlefield advantage, and a good chance of winning. When you spend time commanding, you start to think of an army as a single entity, a massive beast with thousands of limbs. That's a mistake. An army is made up of men, or in this case Trollocs, each one on the field, each one terrified. Being a soldier is about keeping your terror in check. The beast inside just wants to escape."
Lan crouched down, inspecting the battle maps. The situation was much as he'd seen it, only Agomar still had the Saldaean light cavalry watching the eastern flank on the map. A mistake? Lan had confirmed for himself that they were no longer there. Shouldn't runners have brought Agomar word that the map was wrong? Or was he somehow distracting them from noticing?
"I'll show you something today, Lan," Agomar said softly. "I'll show you what the smallest man on the practice yard must learn if he is to survive. You can make the larger enemy break if you convince him that he is going to die. Hit him hard enough, and he will run, and won't return to let you hit again, even if you're secretly too weak to hit again."
"That's your plan, then?" Lan asked.
"Today?" "The Trollocs will break if we show them a display of force that frightens them," Agomar said. "I know it can work. I'm hoping that we can bring down the leader of those dreadlords. If the Trollocs assume they're losing, they will run. They are cowardly beasts."
Listening to Agomar made it seem plausible. Perhaps Lan just wasn't seeing the entire picture. Perhaps the great captain's genius was beyond what others could fathom. Had he done right in countermanding the order to move the archers? The messenger Lan had sent earlier came galloping back to the command center. One of Lan's high guard was there too, holding his own arm, a black-fletched arrow stuck in it.
"An enormous force of Shadowspawn," the messenger said. "Coming in from the east. Daishan, you were right."
They knew to come in that way, Lan thought. They couldn't have just noticed that we'd exposed ourselves, not with those hills blocking their view. It's come too quickly. The Shadow must have been told, or must have known what to expect.
He looked at Aglamar.
"Impossible," Aglamar said. "What's this now? Why didn't the scouts see it?"
"Lord Aglamar," one of his commanders said, "you sent the scouts in the east back to look at the river, remember? They were to inspect the crossing for us. You said the archers would..."
The commander paled.
"The archers?"
"The archers are still in their positions," Lan said, rising. "I want the front lines to begin withdrawing. Pull the Saldarians out of the fighting, ready to strike to help the foot soldiers disengage. Pull the Ashaman back. We'll need gateways."
"Lord Mandragoran," Aglamar said, "this new development can be used. If we pull apart and then smash them between us, we can..."
"You are relieved of duty, Lord Aglamar,"
Lan said, not looking at the man.
"And unfortunately, I must request that you remain under supervision until I can sort through what has happened."
The command tent grew silent, every aide, messenger, and officer turning toward Lan.
"Now, Lan," Aglamar said, "that sounded like you are having me arrested."
"I am," Lan said, motioning to the High Guard.
They moved into the tent, taking positions to keep anyone from escaping. Some of Aglamar's men did reach for swords, but most looked confused and only rested their hands on the hilts.
"This is an outrage," Aglamar said. "Don't be a fool. This isn't the time."
"What would you have me do, Aglamar?" Lan barked. "Let you run this army into the ground? Let the Shadow take us? Why are you doing this? Why?"
"You're overreacting, Lan,"
Aglamar said, keeping his calm with obvious difficulty, his eyes burning.
"What's going through your head? Light."
"Why did you pull the archers off of the eastern hills?"
"Because I needed them elsewhere."
"And does that make sense?" Lan demanded.
"Didn't you tell me that guarding that flank was vital?" "You drew away the scouts from that position, too. Why?"
Aglamar raised a hand to his head, looking dazed. He looked down at the battle map, and his eyes widened.
"What's wrong with you, Aglamar?" Lan said.
"I don't know," the man said.
He blinked, staring at the maps at his feet. His face adopted a look of horror, eyes wide, lips parting.
"Oh, Light, what have I done?"
"Pass my orders," Lan said urgently to his High Guard. "Bring Lord Baldere to the command tent. Queen Atheniella and King Esar as well."
"Lan, you have to bring the..."
Aglamar stopped.
"Light, I can't say it. I start thinking about what to do, and the wrong thoughts come into my head. I'm still trying to sabotage us. I've doomed us."
His eyes wide, he reached for his short sword, sliding the blade free. Lan caught the sword around the guard and the blade collar, stopping it just before Aglamar could ram it into his stomach and end his life. Blood seeped between Lan's fingers from where one brushed the sharp edge of the blade, just below the collar.
"Let me die with honor,"
Aglamar said.
I've destroyed us all. I've lost us this war, Lan."
"Not the war, just the battle," Lan said. "Something is wrong with you. A sickness, a fatigue, or something of the Shadow. I suspect we'll find someone has been tampering with your mind."
"But..."
"You are a soldier," Lan bellowed. "Act like one."
Aglamar froze. He met Lan's eyes, then nodded once. Lan removed his fingers from the blade, and Aglamar thrust it back in its sheath. The great captain sat down cross-legged in the traditional Shinaran meditation position, eyes closed. Lan strode away, calling orders. Prince Kaisel ran up to him, obviously afraid.
"What's happening, Lord Mandragoran?"
"Compulsion, likely," Lan said. "We've been like rabbits in a snare,
with the line being drawn slowly but snugly around our necks. "Someone please tell me the Ashaman still have enough strength for gateways. And bring me news of the eastern flank. Those archers will need support. Commit the rest of the reserves to protecting them."
Prince Kaisel backed away as the orders continued, his eyes wide, his hand on his sword. He looked at Lord Agelmar, face pale.
"We've really lost?"
he asked Lan once the orders were out, messengers racing to deliver them.
"Yes," Lan said. "We have."
"Lan!"
Agelmar said suddenly, opening his eyes. Lan turned to him.
"Queen Zenobia,"
Agelmar said.
"I sent her into danger without understanding what I'd done. Whoever put these plans into my head wanted her dead."
Lan swore softly, bolting out of camp and up the side of the nearest hill. The scouts there made room for him as he reached the top, pulling his looking glass from his belt. He didn't need it. He found the Queen's flag while scanning the battlefield. She was surrounded. Whatever support she had thought she would receive had not been sent. Lan opened his mouth to call orders, but they died on his lips as the Trollocs swarmed over the small flag of white and silver where she'd been fighting. It fell, and in seconds he couldn't pick out a living soldier in that section of the battlefield. Coldness. He could do nothing for Zenobia. It was no longer about saving individuals. He would be lucky to escape this day with any semblance of an army at all. Matt rode with Tuon south toward the battlefield, along the banks of the river that was the western border of Arafel. Of course, where Tuon went, so did Seleucia. And now Min. Tuon wanted to keep her new Doomseer at her side at all times. Tuon kept asking for viewings, and Min kept reluctantly explaining what she saw. Matt had tried to make her say she saw a hat floating around Matt's head. That would persuade Tuon to stop trying to get rid of his, would it not? It would have been better than Min explaining about the eye on a scale and the dagger and all the other bloody things she had seen about Matt. Where Tuon went, 100 of the Death Watch guards also went. And Golgon, and Kurtani, who felt chastised for not acting quickly enough to help Matt. Furyk Kareed went along too, leading the Death Watch guard. Being around Kareed was about as pleasant as finding another man's hand in your purse. But he was a good soldier, and Matt respected him. He would very much like to put Kareed and Lan in a staring contest together. They could be at it for years. "I need a better view," Matt said, scanning the battlefield when they came within range. "There." He turned pips and rode toward a rise close enough to where the opposing forces traded destruction at the river's edge. Tuon followed him without a word. When they all reached the rise, he noticed Seleucia staring daggers at him. "What's wrong?" Matt asked. "I'd have assumed you would be happy to have me back. It gives you someone else to scowl at." "The Empress will follow where you go," she said. "So she will," Matt said. "As I'll follow where she goes, I suppose. I hope that doesn't lead us in too many circles." He inspected the combat. The river was not terribly wide, maybe 50 spans across, but it was swift-moving and deep on either side of the ford. The water made a nice barrier, and not just for Trollocs. The ford, though, made for an easy crossing. The water there was knee-deep and wide enough for at least 20 files of riders to cross at the same time. In the distant middle of the Sharan army, a man sat upon a brilliant white horse. Matt could barely make him out with his glass. The man's glistening armor didn't seem like any Matt had seen, though the distance made it difficult to tell specifics. "I assume that's our Forsaken?" he asked, gesturing with the Ashandarai.
"He seems to be yelling for the Dragon Reborn," Golgon said.
Demandred's voice boomed across the battlefield right then, enhanced by the One Power. He was demanding that the dragon come and face him in a duel. Matt inspected the fellow through the glass.
"Demandred, eh? Has he gone a bit dotty or what?"
Well, Matt knew which part of the battle to bloody stay away from. He had not signed up to fight Forsaken. In fact, so far as he remembered, he had not signed up at all. He had been bloody press-ganged every step of the way.
usually by force and always by one fool woman or another. Egwene could deal with Demandred, or maybe the Ashaman could. Rand said the Ashaman were not going crazy anymore, but that was a shallow promise. Any man who wanted to wield the One Power was already crazy so far as Matt considered it. Adding more crazy to them would be like pouring tea into an already full cup. At least Tuon's Demani had those Sharan channelers occupied. Their firefight ripped up the ground on both riverbanks. It was impossible to get a clear picture of what was going on, though. There was just too much confusion. Matt pointed his looking glass southward along the river once more and frowned. There was a military camp set up just a few hundred paces opposite the ford, but it wasn't the haphazard arrangement of tents that caught his attention. At the eastern edge of the camp was a large body of troops and their horses, just standing there. He picked out a figure pacing in front of the assembly, who appeared to be in a foul mood. Matt might have been missing an eye, but it was no difficult task to recognize Ty Lee. Matt lowered the looking glass. He rubbed his chin, adjusted his hat, and set his Ashandarai on his shoulder. "Give me 5 minutes on my own," he said, then kicked Pips into a gallop down the hill, hoping that Tuon would let him go alone. For once, she did, though as he reached the base of the rise, he could imagine her up there watching him with those curious eyes of hers. She seemed to find everything he did to be interesting. Matt galloped alongside the river toward Ty Lee's location. Explosions rang out, painful to the ears, announcing that he had neared the heart of the battle. Matt nudged Pips to the left and rode directly toward the pacing general. "Ty Lee, you light-blinded fool! Why are you sitting around here instead of making yourself useful?" "Highness," Ty Lee said, falling to her knees. "We were ordered to stay here until we were called." "Who told you to do that? And get up." "General Bryn, Highness," she said, rising. He could sense the annoyance in her tone, but she kept her face under control. "He said that we were only a reserve force, and that under no circumstances were we to move from here until he gave his order. He said many lives depended on it. But look, you can see for yourself," she said, gesturing toward the river. "The battle is not going well." Matt had been too caught up with Ty Lee to see the state of affairs across the water, but now he gave the field a wide sweep with his eye. While the Demani still seemed to be holding their own against the Sharan channelers, the regular troops were clearly in a bind. The defenses on Bryn's left flank downriver had completely broken down, and the soldiers there were being mobbed by Sharans. Where was the cavalry? It was supposed to be protecting the flanks. And, as Matt had predicted, Sharan archers had moved out into the field and were sending arrows into Bryn's cavalry on the right flank. It was all like a boil being squeezed, and Bryn's troops were the boil about to pop. "This doesn't make any bloody sense," Matt said. "He's spinning this more and more into a disaster. Where's the general now, Ty Lee?"
"I cannot say, Highness. I have people out looking for him, but so far there is no word. But I have reports that our side has had a major setback just south of here. Two large cavalry units of General Bryn's have been wiped out by the Sharans just below the hills on the border. It is said they had been sent there to relieve the Marath Damani on the hilltops."
"Blood and bloody ashes," Matt considered this information. "All right, Ty Lee. We can't wait around any longer. Here's what we're going to do. Have Banner General Makoti take the second banner right up the middle. He has to work his way around our troops fighting there and push back those Sharans. You take the third banner and swing around to the right flank. Take out those archers and any other goat-kissers that cross your path. I'm going to take the first banner over to the left flank and put a patch on those defenses. Get going, Ty Lee."
"Yes, Highness. But surely you aren't going to get so close to the battle."
"Yes, I am. Now get going, Ty Lee."
"Please, if I might make a humble suggestion, Highness. You are unprotected. Let me at least give you some proper armor."
Matt thought for a moment, then agreed that her suggestion was a prudent one. A person could get hurt out here, what with arrows flying and blades swinging. Tylee called over one of her senior officers, who seemed to be about the same size as Matt. She had the man remove his armor, which was extremely colorful, overlapping plates lacquered green, gold, and red, outlined with silver. The officer looked bemused when Matt handed him his coat in trade, saying that he expected it to be returned at the end of the day in the same condition. Matt put on the armor, which covered his chest, the back of his arms, and the front of his thighs, and it felt comfortable enough. When the officer held out his helmet, though, Matt ignored him, merely adjusting his wide-brimmed hat as he turned to Tylee.
"Highness, one more thing. The Marath Damani.
I'll deal with those channelers personally," Matt said. She gawked at him as if he were insane. Bloody ashes, he probably was.
"Highness," Tylee said, "the Empress."
She stopped when she saw Matt's expression.
"Let us at least send for some Damani to protect you."
"I can take care of myself just fine, thank you very much. Those bloody women would just get in my way." He grinned. "Are you ready, Tylee? I would really like this over with before it's time for my bedtime mug of ale." In response, Tylee turned and yelled,
"Mount up!"
Light, she had a strong set of lungs. With that, thousands of bottoms hit their saddles, producing a slapping sound that reverberated across the legion, and each soldier sat at attention, eyes straight ahead. He'd give the Shonchan one thing. They trained bloody good soldiers. Tylee barked out a series of orders, turned back to Matt, and said,
"On your command, Highness."
Matt cried out,
"Los Kamadrin!"
Words most of those assembled did not understand, and yet instinctively knew to mean horsemen forward. As Matt spurred Pips into the waters of the ford, the Ashandarai raised above his head, he heard the ground rumble as the first banner closed ranks around him. The blaring Shonchan horns behind were giving the call to charge, each horn pitched slightly differently from the next, producing a grating, dissonant sound meant to be heard at great distances. Ahead, soldiers of the White Tower glanced over their shoulders at the noise, and in the seconds it took Matt and the Shonchan to cross the passage, soldiers were flinging themselves out of the way to make room for the riders. Just a short veer to the left, and the Shonchan were suddenly in the thick of Sharan cavalry, which had been grinding through Egwene's foot soldiers. The speed of their approach enabled the Shonchan vanguard to smash hard into the Sharans, their well-trained steeds rearing up just before crashing down on the foe with their forelegs. Sharans and their mounts fell, many crushed as the Shonchan cavalry continued their relentless forward motion. The Sharans appeared to know what they were about, but these were heavy cavalry, weighted down with burdensome armor and equipped with long lances, perfect for eliminating foot soldiers with their backs up against a wall, but disadvantaged against a highly mobile light cavalry in such tight quarters. The first banner were a crack unit that used a wide variety of weaponry, and they were trained to work in teams. Spears thrown by lead riders with deadly accuracy plunged into the visors of the Sharans, a surprising number of which went through the slits and into faces. Pushing through behind were riders wielding two-handed swords with curved blades, slicing their weapons across vulnerable space that separated helmets from the top of body armor, or at other times slashing the vulnerable chests of armor-clad Sharan mounts, bringing their riders to the ground. Other Shonchan used hooked pole arms to pull Sharans out of the saddle while their partners swung spiked maces at the enemy, denting their armor so much that movement was severely restricted. And when the Sharans were on the ground, trying with difficulty to rise, the spikers would descend on them. Lightly armed Shonchan, whose job it was to pull up visors of the fallen and thrust a narrow dagger into exposed eyes. The lances of the Sharans were useless under these conditions. In fact, they were a hindrance, and many Sharans died before they could drop their lances and draw swords. Matt ordered one of his cavalry squadrons to ride along the water's edge until they reached the far left edge of battle, and then to swing around the Sharan cavalry. No longer overwhelmed by Sharan lances, the White Tower infantry on the left center were able to use their pikes and halberds again, and with the addition of the efforts of the Shonchan second and third banners, defenses were slowly re-established at the ford. It was dirty, slippery work, as the ground within several hundred paces of the river got beaten down and became an expanse of churned-up mud, but the forces of light stood their ground. Matt found himself washed into the thick of the fray, and his Ashendari never stopped spinning. He quickly found, however, that his weapon was not very useful. A few of his swings met with vulnerable flesh, but most of the time his blade glanced off the armor of his opponents, and he was forced to duck and twist in the saddle repeatedly to avoid being struck by a Sharan blade. Matt slowly worked his way forward through the brawl and had nearly reached the back lines of Sharan cavalry when he realized that three of his companions were no longer in their saddles. Odd, they had just been there a minute ago. Two others stiffened up, scanning from side to side, and suddenly they both went up in flames, screaming in agony and throwing themselves to the ground before going limp. Matt looked to his right just in time to see a Shan Chan flung back 100 feet in the air by an unseen force. When he turned back, his eye met the gaze of a most beautiful woman. She was oddly clad in a black silk dress that stood out from her body, adorned with white ribbons. She was a dark-skinned beauty, like Tuon, but there was nothing delicate about her bold, high cheekbones and wide, sensuous mouth, lips that seemed to pout, until they curved up into a smile that was not meant to comfort him. As she stared at him, his medallion grew cold. Matt breathed out. Luck seemed to be with him so far, but he did not want to press it too far, any more than you wanted to press your best racehorse. He would still have a healthy need of that luck in the days to come. Matt dismounted and walked toward her as the woman gasped, trying another weave, her eyes wide with amazement. Matt flipped the Ashendari around and spun it, sweeping her feet from beneath her. He brought the haft just below the blade back down to his right, cracking her on the back of the head as she fell. She landed face down in the mud. Matt did not have time to pull her out as he was suddenly confronted by dozens of Sharans. 10 of Matt's soldiers filled out around him, and he pressed forward. These Sharans only had swords. Matt fended them off with spinning blade and pole, and he and the Shan Chan fought furiously. The fight became a blur of sweeping weapons, his Ashendari spraying clods of mud into the air. 2 of Matt's men grabbed the face-down woman before she could suffocate in the mire. Matt pushed forward. Men yelled, calling for reinforcements. Steps taken cautiously, but inevitably forward. The ground was turning red. Sharn soldiers replaced the ones who were slain, and the bodies of the fallen sank deeper in the mud. Soldiers often were a grim folk, but each of these Sharans seemed personally intent on killing him, until the Sharans stopped coming. Matt looked around him. There were only 4 Shan Chan remaining at his side. Despite the chaos of the fight, Matt felt he saw more clearly than he had before, and the lull in the fighting gave him a chance to act like a commander again. "Bind that woman's hands behind her back," Matt said, panting, to the men around him, "and tie a cloth around her eyes so that she can't see anything." He wiped the sweat from his brow. Light, there was enough of it for a second river. "We are going to push our way back to the ford with our prisoner. I'll see if I can find a few more of those bloody Damani to throw into this battle. The Sharans were wrong to leave only one of their channelers by herself on the battlefield, but let's get out of here before any more of them show up." Matt shook his hand. He had cracked one of his nails, splitting the fine lacquer. He turned to a Shan Chan officer, one of those who had fought alongside him. The man wore an expression of awe, as if he were staring at the dragon bloody reborn himself. Matt looked down at the ground, not liking the man's expression, but he supposed it wasn't any worse than looking at the blood-soaked muck littered with Sharan corpses. How many had Matt killed?
"Highness," the officer said, "great lord, no man in the Empire's service would ever dare question the Empress, may she live forever. But if a man had wondered about some of her choices, she would do so no longer. Prince of the Ravens!"
He raised his sword, prompting a cheer from those behind.
"Get yourselves some bloody pole arms," Matt said. "Those swords are next to useless for foot soldiers in this battle."
He chewed a bit off the offending fingernail, then spat it to the side.
"You fellows did well. Anyone see my horse?"
Pips was nearby, and so, taking his mount's reins, he headed back toward the ford. He even managed to stay out of more skirmishes, for the most part. That Shan Chan captain reminded him a little too much of Telmanis, and Matt had enough people following him about. I wonder if he plays dice, Matt thought idly, stepping into the water. His boots were good, but all boots eventually leaked, and his feet squished inside his stockings as he walked across the ford with Pips. There was a commotion far to his right on the bank, what appeared to be a gathering of Aes Sedai channeling toward the battlefield. But Matt had no intention of sticking his nose into their business. He had larger issues on his mind. Ahead, Matt saw a man standing by a tree, dressed in voluminous pants and a familiar-looking coat. He approached the man, and after a brief conversation, exchanged garb with him. Feeling good about being back in his Two Rivers coat, Matt heaved himself into the saddle, legs still dripping water, and rode back toward where he had left Tuon. His men had brought that Sharan channeler. By his order, they'd gagged her and blindfolded her. Light, what would he do with her? She'd probably end up as a Damani. He left his soldiers and passed the guards, now set up at the base of the little rise, with barely a nod. The battlefield spread out in his mind, no longer little drawings on paper. He could see the field, hear the men fighting, smell the rancid breath of the enemy. It was real to him now. "The Empress," Seleucia said as he reached the top of the rise, "would like to know, with great specificity, exactly why you saw fit to put yourself into the skirmish in such an irresponsible way. Your life is no longer your own, Prince of the Ravens. You cannot toss it aside as you once might have." "I had to know," Matt said, looking out. "I had to feel the pulse of the battle." "The pulse," Seleucia said. Tuon was talking through her by wiggling her fingers like some bloody maiden of the spear, not speaking to him directly. Bad sign. "Every battle has a pulse, Tuon," Matt said, still staring into the middle distance. "Nynaeve, she would sometimes feel a person's hand to check their heartbeat, and from there would know that something was wrong with their feet. It's the same thing. Step into the struggle, feel its motion. Know it." A servant with his head half-shaven stepped up to Tuon, whispering to her and Seleucia. He had come from the ford. Matt kept looking out, remembering maps, but overlaying them with the real combat. Bryn failing to use Tylee in combat, exposing his defense's left flank at the ford, sending his cavalry into a trap. The battle opened to him, and he saw tactics 10 steps ahead of what was occurring. It was like reading the future, like what Min saw, only with flesh, blood, swords, and battle drums. Matt grunted. "Huh. Garth Bryn is a dark friend."
"He what?"
Min sputtered. "This battle is one step away from being doomed," Matt said, turning to Tuon. "I need absolute control of our armies right now. No more arguing with Golgon. Min, I need you to send to Egwene and warn her that Bryn is trying to lose this battle. Tuon, she'll need to go in person. I doubt Egwene will listen to anyone else." Everyone looked at Matt with stunned expressions. Everyone but Tuon, who gave him one of those soul-shaking stares of hers. The ones that had him feeling as if he were a mouse who had just been caught in an otherwise immaculately clean room. That made him sweat more than the battle had.
"Come on," he thought. "There isn't time."
He could see it now, like a grand game of stones. Bryn's movements were complex and subtle, but the end result would be the destruction of Egwene's army. Matt could stop it, but he had to act now.
"It is done," Tuon said.
The comment provoked almost as much surprise as Matt's announcement. Captain General Golgon looked as if he would rather swallow his own boots than have Matt in command. Min found herself being led away by a group of servants and soldiers, and she gave a squawk of annoyance. Tuon moved her horse nearer to Matt's.
"I am told," she said softly, "that in the battle moments ago, you not only claimed Amarath Damani for yourself, but also raised one of our officers to the low blood."
"I did?" Matt asked, baffled. "I don't remember that."
"You dropped your nail at his feet."
"Oh, that... all right, maybe I did that. Accidentally. And the channeler...
Bloody ashes, Tuan. I didn't mean for her to... I guess. Well, you can have her.
No, Tuan said. It is well for you to have taken one of your own. You cannot train her, of course, but there are many Suldam who will be eager for the chance. It is very rare that a man captures a Damani personally on the battlefield. Very rare indeed. Though I know of your particular advantage, others do not. This will greatly increase your reputation.
Matt shrugged. What else could he do? Maybe if the Damani belonged to him, he could let her free or something.
I will have the officer you raised transferred to be your personal retainer, Tuan said. He has a good record, perhaps too good. He had been assigned that duty at the Ford because he was considered potentially part of a faction who would have moved against us. He is now spouting your praises. I do not know what you did to change his opinion. You seem to have a particular skill at that.
Let's just hope I have as much skill for retrieving a victory, Matt grumbled. This is bad, Tuan.
Nobody else thinks so.
She said the words carefully, not arguing with him really, stating a fact.
I'm right anyway. I wish I wasn't, but I am. I bloody am.
If you are not, I will lose influence.
You'll be fine, Matt said, leading the way back toward the Seanchan camp a few miles north at a brisk pace. I may lead you wrong now and then, but in the end, you can be sure that I'm always a safe bet.
Chapter 30 The Way of the Predator.
Perrin and Gaul did another dismayed round of Egwene's camp, at Laos North at a brisk pace. I may lead you wrong now and then, but in the end, you can be sure that I'm always a safe bet.
Chapter 30 The Way of the Predator. Perrin and Gaul did another dismayed round of Egwene's camp, at least the little bit of it that reflected in the wolf dream. Her army had been pushed far to the east, and the tents had not been placed long enough at the river to reflect strongly in the wolf dream. The wolves had spotted Grendel here, but Perrin had not been able to catch her at whatever she was doing. 3 times now Slayer had tried attacking the boar, and the wolves had warned Perrin. Each time Slayer had withdrawn before Perrin arrived. The man was testing them. It was the way of the predator, surveying the herd, searching for the weak. At least Perrin's plan with the wolves had worked. Time progressed slowly in the boar, and so Slayer, by necessity, was slowed down as he tried to reach Rand. That gave Perrin a chance to reach him in time.
We need to warn the others about Grendel, Perrin said, stopping in the center of camp. She must be communicating with dark friends in our camps.
Perhaps we could go to those at the boar. You managed to speak to Nynaeve Sedai.
Maybe, Perrin said. I don't know if it would be good to distract Nynaeve again, considering what she is up to.
Perrin turned about, looking at the bedrolls that flickered, then vanished in the wolf dream. He and Gaul had checked at Marilor for a gateway, but none was there currently. If he wanted to go back to the waking world, he'd need to camp there and wait for hours. It seemed like such a waste. If only he could figure out how to shift back to the real world himself. Lanfear implied that he might be able to learn the trick, but his only clue in how to do so lay in Slayer. Perrin tried remembering the moment when the man had shifted out. Had Perrin sensed anything? A hint to how Slayer did what he did? He shook his head. He'd gone over and over that, and had come to no conclusions. With a sigh, he quested out for the wolves.
"Any sign of Heartseeker?"
he asked hopefully. The wolves sent amusement. He had been asking them too frequently.
"Have you seen any camps of two legs, then?"
Perrin sent. This earned a vague response. Wolves paid attention to men only to avoid them. In the wolf dream, that didn't matter much. Still, where men congregated, nightmares sometimes ran wild, so the wolves had learned to keep their distance. He would have liked to know how the other battles were progressing. What of Elaine's army, Perrin's men, Lord and Lady Bashir? Perrin led Gaul away. They ran with quick strides rather than jumping to a place immediately. Perrin wanted to think. The longer he remained in the wolf dream in the flesh, the more he felt that he should know how to shift back. His body seemed to understand that this place was not natural for it. He hadn't slept here, despite... how long had it been? He could not say. They were almost at the end of their rations, though he felt as though he and Gaul had been here only a handful of hours. Part of that sensation was caused by frequent approaches to the boar to check on the dream spike. But it was generally so easy to lose track of time here. There was also an ache of fatigue inside him, growing stronger. He didn't know if he could sleep in this place. His body wanted rest, but had forgotten how to find it. It reminded him a little of when Moiraine had dispelled their fatigue while fleeing the two rivers all that time ago. 2 years now. A very long 2 years. Perrin and Gaul inspected Lan's camp next. It was even more ephemeral than Egwene's. Using the wolf dream for surveillance here was pointless. Lan moved with lots of cavalry, retreating at speed. He and his men did not remain in one place long enough to reflect in the wolf dream except in the most fleeting of ways. There were no signs of Grendel.
Anna Lan is retreating too, Gaul guessed, surveying the rocky ground that they thought was Lan's camp.
There were no tents here, just the occasional fleeting appearance of sleeping rings marked by a pole at the center where horsemen would hobble their animals. Gaul looked up, scanning the landscape to the west.
If they keep falling back from here, they will eventually reach the field of Merilor again. Perhaps that is the goal.
Perhaps, Perrin said.
I want to visit Elaine's battlefront and...
Young Bull,
a wolf called to him. He found the voice of the sending to be familiar somehow.
She is here.
Here?
Perrin sent.
Heartseeker? Come.
Perrin grabbed Gaul by the arm and shifted them far to the north. Grendel was at Shale Ghul? Was she trying to break in and kill Rand? They arrived on a ledge overlooking the valley. He and Gaul went down immediately to their stomachs, peering over the edge, inspecting the valley. An old, grizzled wolf appeared beside Perrin. He knew this wolf. He was certain of it. The scent was familiar, but he could not place a name to him, and the wolf did not send one.
Where?
Perrin whispered.
Is she in the cavern?
No,
the grizzled wolf sent.
There.
The wolf sent an image of tents clustered in the valley just below the entrance to the cavern. She had not been spotted in this valley since that first time Perrin had caught her here. Aitarolda's troops had been holding here for long enough that their tents were becoming more and more stable in the wolf dream. Perrin shifted carefully down below. Gaul and the wolf joined him as he prowled forward, relying on the wolf's sending to lead him.
There,
the wolf said, nodding toward a large tent at the center. Perrin had seen Grendel here before, at this tent, the tent of Rodal Aitarolda. Perrin froze as the tent's flap rustled. Grendel stepped out. She looked as she had before, with a face like a slab of rock. Perrin created a thin, painted wall to hide himself, but he needn't have bothered. Grendel immediately created a gateway and stepped into the waking world. It was night there, though time passed at such a strange rate this close to the boar, that might not mean much for the rest of the world. Perrin could see the same tent darkly on the other side of the gateway. Two Demoni guards out front. Grendel waved a hand, and both stood up straighter and saluted her. The gateway began to close as Grendel slipped into the tent. Perrin hesitated, then shifted to stand just in front of the gateway. He had a moment to decide.
Follow?
No. He had to keep watch on Slayer. However, being this close, he felt something. An awareness. Stepping through that gateway would be like... waking up. The gateway snapped shut. Perrin felt a stab of regret, but knew staying in the wolf dream had been right. Rand was all but defenseless against Slayer here. He would need Perrin's help.
"We need to send a warning," Perrin said.
"I suppose I could take the message for you, young bull," said the unnamed wolf.
Perrin froze, then spun, pointing.
"Elias!"
"I am Longtooth here, young bull."
Elias sent amusement.
"I thought you said you didn't come here."
"I said I avoided it. This place is strange and dangerous. I have enough strangeness and danger in my life in the other world."
The wolf sat down on his haunches.
"But someone needed to check on you, foolish pup."
Perrin smiled. Elias's thoughts were a strange mix of wolf and human. His way of sending was very wolf-like, but the way he thought of himself was too individual, too human.
"How goes the fight?"
Perrin asked eagerly. Gaul took up position nearby, watching, alert, in case Grendel or Slayer appeared. The field before them, the floor of the valley, was quiet for once. The winds had died down, the dust on the sandy ground stirring in small rifts and ripples, like water.
"I do not know of the other battlefields," Elias sent, "and we wolves stay far from the two legs. We fight, here and there, at the edges of the battle. Mostly we have attacked the Twisted Ones and Neverborn from the other side of the canyon, where there are no two legs except those strange Aiel. It is a grueling fight. Shadow Killer must do quick work. We have stood 5 days, but may not last many more."
5 days here in the north. Much longer had passed in the rest of the world since Rand entered to face the Dark One. Rand himself was so close to the boar that it was likely only hours, maybe minutes, had passed for him. Perrin could feel how time moved differently when he drew near to where Rand fought.
"I Torolda,"
Perrin said, scratching at his beard.
"He's one of the great captains."
"Yes," Elias sent, smelling of amusement. "Some call him Little Wolf."
"Bashir is with Elaine's army," Perrin said. "And Garth Bryn is with Egwene. Agomar is with the Borderlanders and Lan." "I do not know." "He is. 4 battlefronts, 4 great captains." "That's what she's doing."
"Grendel?" Gaul asked.
"Yes,"
Perrin said, anger gathering.
"She's doing something to them, changing their minds, corrupting them. I overheard her saying, 'Yes, that's it, I'm certain. Instead of fighting our armies with armies of her own, she plans to bring down the great captains.' Elias, do you know how a man can shift in and out of the wolf dream in the flesh?"
"Even if I knew this thing, which I do not, I would not teach it to you," Elias said with a growl. "Has nobody told you it is a terrible, dangerous thing you do?"
"Too many,"
Perrin said.
"Light, we need to warn Bashir. I must—"
"Perrin Ebarra," Gaul said, pointing.
"He is here."
Perrin spun to see a dark blur streak upward toward the entrance to the Pit of Doom. Wolves whimpered and died. Others howled, beginning the hunt. This time Slayer did not back away. The way of the predator. 2 or 3 quick lunges to determine weakness, then an all-out attack.
"Wake,"
Perrin called to Elias, running up the incline.
"Warn Elaine, Egwene, anyone you can. And if you cannot, stop Itaralda somehow. The great captains are being corrupted. One of the Forsaken controls their minds, and their tactics cannot be trusted."
"I will do it, young bull,"
Elias sent, fading.
"Go to Rand, Gaul," Perrin roared. "Guard the way to him. Do not let any of those red bales pass you."
Perrin summoned his hammer to his hands, not waiting for a reply, then shifted to confront Slayer. Rand clashed with Moradin, sword against sword, standing before the darkness that was the essence of the Dark One. The cold expanse was somehow both infinite and empty. Rand held so much of the One Power that he nearly burst. He would need that strength in the fight to come. For now, he resisted Moradin's sword against sword. He wielded Kalandor as a physical weapon, fighting as if with a sword made of light itself, parrying Moradin's attacks. Each step Rand took dripped blood to the ground. Nynaeve and Moiraine clung to the stalagmites as if something were battering them, a wind that Rand could not sense. Nynaeve closed her eyes. Moiraine stared straight ahead as if determined not to look away, no matter the price. Rand turned aside Moradin's latest attack, the blades throwing sparks. He had always been the better swordsman of the two during the Age of Legends. He had lost his hand, but thanks to Tam, that no longer mattered as it once might have. And he was also wounded. This place changed things. Rocks on the ground seemed to move, and he often stumbled. The air grew alternately musty and dry, then humid and moldy. Time slipped around them like a stream. Rand felt as if he could see it. Each blow here took moments, yet hours passed outside. He scored Moradin across the arm, drawing his blood to spray against the wall.
"My blood and yours," Rand said. "I have you to thank for this wound in my side, Aelon. You thought you were the Dark One, didn't you? Has he punished you for that?"
"Yes," Moradin snarled. "He returned me to life."
Moradin came swinging hard in a two-handed blow. Rand stepped backward, catching the blow on Kalandor, but he misjudged the slope of the ground. Either that or the slope changed on him. Rand stumbled, the blow forcing him down on one knee. Blade against blade. Rand's leg slipped backward and brushed the darkness behind, which waited like a pool of ink. All went black.
The distant Ogier song was comforting to Elaine as she slumped in her saddle atop the hill just north of Kyrian. The women around her weren't in any better shape than she was. Elaine had gathered all of the kinswomen who could hold on to Saidar, no matter how weak or tired, and formed two circles with them. She had 12 with her in her own circle, but their collective strength in the power at the moment was barely more than that of a single Aes Sedai. Elaine had stopped channeling in an attempt to let the women recover. Most of them slumped in their saddles or sat on the ground. In front of them extended a ragged battle line. Men fought desperately before the Kyrianan hills, trying to hold against the sea of Trollocs. Their victory over the northern Trolloc army had been short-lived, as they now found themselves strung out, exhausted, and in serious danger of being surrounded by the southern one. "We almost managed," Arganda said from beside her, shaking his head. "We almost made it." He wore a plume in his helmet. It had belonged to Galen. Elaine hadn't been there when the Mienor commander had fallen. That was the frustrating part. They were close. Despite Bashir's betrayal, despite the unexpected arrival of the southern force, they had almost pulled it off. If she'd had more time to position her men, if they'd been able to catch more than a moment's breather between defeating the northern army and then turning to meet this southern one. But that was not the case. Nearby, the proud Ogier fought to protect the dragons, but the Ogier were slowly being overrun. The ancient creatures had begun to collapse, like felled trees, pulled down by Trollocs. One by one, their songs broke off. Arganda held a bloodied hand to his side, pale-faced, barely able to speak. She didn't have the strength to heal him. "That warder of yours is a fiend on the battlefield, Your Majesty. Her arrows fly like light itself. I'd swear..." Arganda shook his head. He might never hold a sword again, even if healed. He should have been sent with the other wounded... somewhere. There wasn't really anywhere to take them. The channelers were too exhausted to make gateways. Her people were fracturing. The Aiel fought in clumps, the White Cloaks nearly surrounded, the Wolf Guard in no better shape. The Legion of the Dragon heavy cavalry still rode, but Bashir's betrayal had shaken them. Now and then a dragon fired. Aludra had rolled them back up to the top of the highest hill, but they were out of ammunition, and the channelers didn't have strength to make gateways to Bearlawn to fetch the new dragon's eggs. Aludra had fired bits of armor until her powder ran low. Now they had only enough for the occasional shot. The Trollocs would push through her lines soon, fragmenting her army like ravenous lions. Elaine watched from one of the hilltops, guarded by 10 of her guardswomen. The rest had gone to fight. Trollocs broke through the Aiel to the east of her position, right near the Dragoner hilltop position. The beasts charged up the hill, killing the few Ogier defenders on that side, roaring their victory as the Dragoners pulled out sabers and grimly stood to defend. Elaine wasn't ready to let the dragons go yet. She gathered strength through the circle. Women groaned around her. She took up barely a dribble of the power, far less than she'd hoped, and directed fire at the lead Trollocs. Her attack arced in the air toward the shadow spawn. She felt she was trying to stop a storm by spitting at the wind. That lone ball of fire hit. The earth exploded beneath it, ripping the hillside and hurling dozens of Trollocs back in the air. Elaine started, causing Moonshadow to shuffle beneath her. Arganda cursed. Someone rode up beside her on a large black horse, emerging as if from smoke. The man was of medium build and had dark curls of hair down to his shoulders. Loghain looked thinner than she remembered from last time she'd seen him, his cheeks sunken, but his face was still handsome. "Loghain?" she said, shocked. The Ashaman gestured sharply. Explosions sounded all across the battlefield. Elaine turned to see over 100 men in black coats marching through a large gateway on top of her hill. "Pull those Ogier back," Loghain said. His ragged voice was raw. Those eyes of his seemed darker now than they once had been. "We will hold this position." Elaine blinked, then nodded for Arganda to pass the command. "Loghain shouldn't give orders to me," she thought absently. For the moment she let it pass. Loghain turned his horse and rode to the side of the hilltop, looking down at her army. Elaine followed, feeling numb. Trollocs fell as Ashaman called up strange attacks, gateways that seemed tied to the ground somehow. They stormed forward, killing the shadow spawn. Loghain grunted. "You're in bad shape." She forced her mind to work. The Ashaman were here. "Did Rand send you?"
"We sent ourselves,"
Loghain said.
"The Shadow has been planning this trap for a long time, according to notes in Taim's study. I only just managed to decipher them."
He looked at her.
"We came to you first. The Black Tower stands with the Lion of Andor."
"We need to get my people out of here," Elaine said, forcing her mind to think through the cloud of fatigue. Her army needed a queen. "Mother's milk in a cup. This is going to cost us." She'd probably lose half her force withdrawing. Better half than all of them. "I'll start bringing my men back in ranks. Can you make enough gateways to lead us to safety?"
"That wouldn't be a problem,"
Loghain said absently, looking down the slope. His impassive face would have impressed any warder.
"But it will be a slaughter. There's no room for a good retreat, and your lines will grow weaker and weaker as you pull back. The last ranks will be overwhelmed and consumed."
"I don't see that we have any other choice," Elaine snapped, exhausted. "Light! Here, help had come, and she was snapping. Stop it!" She composed herself, sitting up straighter. "I mean to say that Your arrival, while appreciated greatly, cannot turn a battle that is this far gone. 100 Ashaman cannot stop 100,000 Trollocs on their own. If we could arrange our battle lines better, get at least a short rest for my men. But no, that is impossible. We must retreat, unless you can produce a miracle, Lord Loghain. He smiled, perhaps at her use of Lord for him.
Andral,
he barked. A middle-aged Ashaman hurried over, a plump Aes Sedai joining him. Pavara? Elaine thought, too exhausted to make sense of it. A red? My lord, the man, Andral asked.
I need to slow that army of Trollocs long enough for the army to regroup and refield itself, Andral,
Loghain said.
How much will it cost us for a miracle?
Well, my lord, Andral said, rubbing his chin.
That depends. How many of those women sitting back there can channel?
It was a thing of legends. Elaine had heard of the great works performed by large circles of men and women. Every woman in the White Tower was taught of these feats from the past. Stories of different days, better days. Days when one half of the one power had not been a thing to fear. When two halves of one whole had worked together to create incredible wonders. She wasn't sure the days of legend had truly returned. Certainly the Aes Sedai during those times hadn't been so worried, so desperate. But what they did now left Elaine in awe. She joined in the circle, making the total 14 women and 12 men. She barely had any strength to lend, but her trickle added to the increasingly large stream. More importantly, a circle had to have at least one more woman than it had men, and now that she had joined, Loghain could come in last of all and add his considerable strength to the flow. At the head of this circle was Andral, an odd choice. Now that she was part of the circle, she could feel his relative strength. He was extremely weak, weaker than many women who were turned away from the tower, refused the shawl because of their lack of innate talent. Elaine and the others had relocated to the far side of the battlefield. The rest of the Ashaman held back the attacking Trolloc horde as Andral prepared. Whatever he did, it would need to be swift. Elaine still had trouble believing anything could be done. Even with this much power, even with 13 men and 14 women working together. Light, Andral whispered, standing between her horse and Loghain's. Is this what it feels like to be one of you people? How do you handle so much of the one power? How do you keep it from consuming you alive, burning you away? Pavara rested her hand on his shoulder in a gesture that was unmistakably tender. Elaine could barely rub two thoughts together amid her fatigue, but she still found herself shocked. She had not expected affection from a red, for a man who could channel. Move the soldiers back, Andral said softly. Elaine gave the order, worried. The man beside her had never held this kind of power before. It could go to someone's head. She had seen it happen. Light send that he knew what he was doing. The soldiers and others retreated, passing by Elaine's group. Several tired Ogier nodded to her in passing, their shoulders slumped, their arms scored with cuts. The Trollocs poured forward, but the Ashaman who weren't in the circle disrupted their attack with weaves of the one power. It wasn't enough. Though the Ashaman fought well, there were just so many Trollocs. The Ashaman could not stop this tide. What did Loghain think could be done? Andral smiled widely and held his hands out in front of himself as if pressing against a wall. He closed his eyes. 3,000 years ago, the Lord Dragon created Dragonmount to hide his shame. His rage still burns hot. Today, I bring it to you, Your Majesty. A beam of light split the air easily 100 feet tall, Moonshadow shied back and Elaine frowned. Why a column of light? What good would that... The beam of light began to twist in the air, rotating upon itself. Only then did Elaine recognize it for the start of a gateway. An enormous gateway, large enough to swallow buildings. She could have moved an entire wing of the Camelin Palace through that thing. The air shimmered in front of them, the way a gateway always looked from behind. She couldn't see where the gateway was leading. Did they have an army waiting on the other side? She could see the expressions on the slavering Trolloc faces as they looked into the opening. Absolute horror. They broke away, running, and Elaine felt a sudden heat, almost overpowering. Something exploded out of the gateway as if pushed by an incredible force. A column of lava 100 feet in diameter, blazing hot. The column broke apart as the lava crashed down, splashing to the battlefield, gushing forward in a river. The Ashaman outside the circle used weaves of air to keep it from splashing back on the circle and to shepherd it in the right direction. The river of fire washed through the foremost Trolloc ranks, consuming them, destroying hundreds in an eye blink. The lava was under pressure on the other side. That was the only way she could explain the force with which it sprayed from the enormous gateway, turning Trollocs into cinders, burning a large swath through their army. Andral held the gateway for long minutes as the Shadow's army pulled back. Ashaman to the sides used gusts of wind to blow the Shadow Spawn back into the ever-widening river. By the time Andral finished, he had created a barrier of red-hot death between Elaine's army and the bulk of the Trollocs, whose backs were against the northern walls of Kyrian. Andral took a breath, closed the gateway, then pivoted and made two others in quick succession, one pointing southeast, the other southwest. A second and third column of lava spurted forth, smaller this time, as Andral was obviously weakened. These went tumbling over the land to the east and west of Kyrian, singeing away dead weeds and casting smoke into the air. Some of the Trolloc army had pulled back, but many others had perished, boxed in, with the walled city on one side and lava on others. It would be some time before the Fades could organize the survivors to resume their attacks on Elaine's forces. Andral let the gateway close. He slumped, but Pavara caught him. "One miracle, my lord," Andral said, voice soft as if strained. "Delivered as requested. That should hold them back for a few hours. Long enough." "Long enough," Elaine said. "We will be able to regroup, bring through supplies for the dragons, and fetch as many Aes Sedai from Mayen as we can get to heal our men and wash away their fatigue. Then we can sort through who is strong enough to continue and reposition our ranks for a much more effective battle." "You intend to keep fighting?" Andral asked, surprised. "Yes," Elaine said. "I can barely stand, but yes. We cannot afford to leave that Trolloc horde here intact. You and your men give us an edge, Loghain. We will use it, and everything we have, and we will destroy them." Chapter 31. A Tempest of Water. Egwene looked across the river at the struggle raging between her forces and the Sharan army. She'd arrived back at her camp on the Arafelan side of the ford. She was itching to join the battle against the Shadow again, but she also needed to talk with Bryn about what had happened at the hills. She had arrived to find the command tent empty. The camp continued to fill with Aes Sedai and the surviving archers and pikemen who were coming through gateways from the hilltops to the south. The Aes Sedai were milling about and speaking to each other with some urgency. They all seemed worn out, but it was clear from their frequent glances toward the battle taking place across the river that they were as eager as Egwene was to rejoin the fight against the Shadow. Egwene summoned the messenger who was standing in front of the command tent. Get word to the sisters that they will have less than an hour to rest. Those Trollocs we were fighting will be joining the battle at the river soon, now that we have left the hills. She'd move the Aes Sedai downriver on this side, then attack them across the water as they moved across the fields to attack her soldiers. Tell the archers they'll be marching with us as well, she added. They may as well put their remaining arrows to good use, until we can get them another supply. As the messenger rushed off, Egwene turned to Lyalwyn, who was standing with her husband Bael Domon nearby. Lyalwyn, those look like Seanchan cavalry troops across the river. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, mother, they are Seanchan. That man standing over there.
She pointed to a man with shaved temples standing by a tree down toward the river. He wore voluminous trousers and, incongruously, a tattered brown coat, which looked as if it might have come from the Two Rivers.
He told me that a legion commanded by Lieutenant General Kirgan had come from the Seanchan camp, and that they had been summoned by General Bryn.
He also said that they do be accompanied by the Prince of Ravens,
Domon interjected. Matt?
He did more than accompany them. He do be leading one of the cavalry banners, the ones giving the Sharans a hiding on our army's left flank. He got there just in time. Our pikemen were getting the worst of it before he showed up.
Egwene, Gawain said, pointing. To the south, a few hundred paces below the ford, a small number of soldiers were hauling themselves from the river. They had stripped to their small clothes and carried swords tied to their backs. It was too far to be sure, but one of their leaders looked familiar. Is that Uno? Egwene frowned, then waved for her horse. She mounted and galloped with Gawain and her guards along the river to where the men lay gasping on the bank, and the sound of one man cursing filled the air.
Uno! It's about bloody flaming time someone came.
Uno stood as he saluted in respect.
Mother, we're in bad shape.
I saw.
Egwene gritted her teeth. I was in the hills when your force was attacked. We did what we could, but there were just too many of them. How did you get out?
How did we flaming get out, Mother? When the men started dropping all around us and we figured we were goners, we flaming rode out of there like a flaming lightning bolt had struck our flaming hindquarters. We got to the frog-kissing river on the run, stripped and jumped in, swimming for all we were bloody worth, Mother, with all due respect.
Uno's topknot danced as he continued to blaspheme, and Egwene could have sworn the eye painted on his eye patch became a more intense red. Uno took a deep breath and continued, a little more subdued.
I can't understand it, Mother. Some goat-headed messenger told us that the Aes Sedai on the hills were in trouble and we needed to go up the flaming backsides of the Trollocs attacking them. I said, who's going to mind the left flank at the river? And for that bloody matter, our own bloody flank when we attacked the Trollocs. And he said that General Bryn had that taken care of. Reserve cavalry would move up into our position at the river, and the Ilianers would watch out for our bloody flanks. Some protection they were, all right. One flaming squadron like a flaming fly trying to fend off a flaming falcon. Oh, they were just waiting for us, like they knew we was coming. No, Mother, this can't be the fault of Gareth Bryn. We've been tricked by some sheep-gutted, milk-drinking traitor. With all due respect, Mother.
I can't believe that, Uno. I just heard that General Bryn had brought in a legion of Seanchan cavalry. Maybe they were simply late getting here. We'll sort it all out when I find the general. Meanwhile, get your men back to camp so they can have a proper rest. Light knows you've earned it.
Uno nodded, and Egwene galloped back toward camp.
Using Vora's Sangreal, Egwene wove air and water, spinning them together.